Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, Roger Shattuck, is the self-made literary scholar most famous for A, his celebratory biography of the novelist Marcel Proust, and B, for his drawing of the critical line against those episodically fashionable works of the Marquis de Sade and the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, mad rantings of sexual perversion and political power lust with demonstrably evil effects on the world to this day, Roger Shattuck argues. But then the next question is, what do you do with standards like that once you've raised them? What is a sophisticated modern reader and teacher to do with this idea that literature is a central field of human experience that casts a radiant light on all of our lives, that it has a moral component challenging every reader to talk back to our authors and to our culture? What Roger Shattuck has done is to talk back with more and more spirit and independence. As a teacher, a reviewer, and an author in his own right, he's a reader with an attitude, and he presides this hour over the Connection Book Club. Connection listeners, are you prepared for a great books professor who goes right out and lists the top 10 classics of candor and the bottom 10 monstrosities of perversion in the literature that we all know or are supposed to know? Are there books, as Roger Shattuck believes, that every literate person ought to read? Is there a canon? Are you aware that we're standing right in front of the canon even now? 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Roger Shattuck connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Roger Shattuck, I think the simplest way to sort of tell people what you're talking about is to read the list, the 10 top and the 10 bottom, and why.
All right, I'll get into that. I just want to say first that I have a very good publicist at Norton, but I would love to have you on my publicist list also.
Well, I love reading you, and I want to argue with you a lot of things. I want to learn a lot of things from you.
Well, I have in front of me, because I forgot them, the two top 10 lists of notably candid books and notably perverse books.
And what does candor stand for? We know what perversion means, but what's candor all about?
Candor is honesty, frankness, straightforwardness, and the possibility of getting at a subject without without deviousness. But let me tell you how these happened. I didn't dream these up as a possibility of getting on a program like this. My publicist there, who is Jennifer, and my editor, Bob Weil, were trying to think of how to promote this book called Candor and Perversion. And their great insight was to say, well, Roger, draw up a list of books, the 10 perverse books and the 10 candid books, which I rejected out of hand as being a ridiculous promotional scheme. And then I did a second thought on it and decided that maybe it would be worth trying. And it's one of the most difficult jobs I've ever had, to describe 20 books, each in about 4 or 5 lines. I'll read you a few of them and in order, and we'll see. I mean, I read them all. But this is a way of suggesting that after having written a book like Candor and Perversion, you have to then apply these standards to other works. So let's start with the candid books. These are the good books. These are the books that we hope will go down in history, that more people will read. The Beulah Quintet by Mary Lee Settle. I put this first, not because I think it is the first of all books, but because it is the most neglected at the present moment. It is a great 5-volume historical novel, as I say here, which traces certain recurring traits in a family line from the time of Cromwell up to the present in West Virginia. Mary Lee Settle is still alive in Vermont and writing her last, or at least a new novel, already in her 80s. Personal Knowledge by Michael Polanyi. It takes a philosophically trained mind to read this work, to read the works of this physician-turned-philosopher. And then I say, whereas E.O. Wilson, who is on my other list, becomes imprisoned in his doctrine of reductionism, Polanyi deals scrupulously with basic acts of learning and intelligence. Now a novel that almost everyone will recognize, I hope they will anyway, which I think is the greatest American novel, Absalom by William Faulkner. I don't think I need to do my thumbnail rundown on this. That book, with its intensity and with its historical sweep, brings all of us in. The Stranger by Albert Camus. I almost attack this book in my earlier work, Forbidden Knowledge, but here I would propose it as a novel of great directness in reaching our minds and posing the problems of language and of history, as I say here, and morality. In Search of Lost Time, this is my own personal favorite, the Proust novel. It runs to 3,000 pages. Maybe it's too long, but I believe it is not too long if one can get on the wave, as a surfer gets on the wave and move with it through maybe a whole year it would take to read it. But this is a novel of quest, which is both found and then found too late. I want to do one more. The Story of My Life by Helen Keller. This used to be on the shelves of every high school. It was read by every student in some grade. It is now disappearing for reasons I do not understand. What it relates is the immediate, most intimate process of learning about language, but it's done so late that it is done in a different way from those of us who go through this at the age, from birth up, between the ages of 1 and 3, when we learn to talk. It's a very revealing book and an extremely revealing book. Her teacher, Annie Sullivan, comes down and says that the first thing that this savage must learn is obedience. Obedience. This would set all our educationists on their ear, but there it is. The other four on this list are War and Peace, Either Or by Soren Kierkegaard, War and Peace by Tolstoy, Either Or by Soren Kierkegaard, Democracy in America, and Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Why Frankenstein?
Frankenstein I put on there because I believe that even though it's not the best written novel in the world, it is one of the most cleverly structured. It is built like wheels within wheels until you finally come almost to the central point of the novel by sheer structural focusing, and because it is an answer to a work that is generally considered much greater, namely Goethe's Faust. Faust I see as a great work which introduces the great theme of overreaching, of hubris, into our culture in a way much more central than that in ancient Greece, but that the great Faust himself, the figure of a Frankenstein in his own way, and who goes through life with his education, able to do almost anything, but leaving behind him a number of bodies. He is really responsible for the death of 11 characters in Faust. He is nevertheless wafted off to heaven on a band of angels at the end, in spite of his misdeeds. It is, although the Germans consider it their greatest novel, I find it a pretty sinister novel, and it is on my other list. Goethe's Faust.
Before you get to the other list, I just want to say, I mean, it is completely fascinating to me when a certified highbrow can reduce sort of his great books to a short list. It's a fascinating range, too. Mostly fiction, French, American, and Russian fiction. An interesting range, very eclectic European philosophy. Kierkegaard, Tolstoy counts as kind of beyond sociology. But Frankenstein, too. And the Helen Keller story. What's the thread here?
The thread is candor. The thread is to... Well, this is the game I played. I played the game because I was put up to it by my publicist. But then I found it was a really challenging game, and one that I was going to go ahead and play in spite of my first refusal. And the thread is candor. The thread is that these are books which over time have stayed in my mind and convinced me that they are either neglected or that they are so important that I'm not going to leave them off this list. Now, do you want me to go on to the...
Yeah, the bad guy list.
I'm the bad guy?
No, the bad guy list.
Well, yes, it's the bad guy list. The bad guy list is coming up. All right, I put, because I have to, after having written the book Forbidden Knowledge, I put a recent biography of the Marquis de Sade called At Home with the Marquis de Sade, A Life by Francine Duplexis Gray. I'll read this one. The leap of imagination that makes Gray want to domesticate a monster arises from profound naivete about human character. Why do women often sympathize with a cruel seducer? And I mean cruel. This man was a murderer. What is even more insidious, certain contemporary critics have set out to rehabilitate Saad's unspeakable writings. Period. That's the end of it, but this I put as number one.
Can I disagree with you?
Yes, you.
I mean, to me, we did a very interesting program with Francine Duplessis-Gray, and what stuck in my mind was the incredible parallelism with the lives of Hillary and Bill Clinton. And there is something, I mean, it's different, but there is something chronic, eternal, and maybe deeply human about the attachment of the wife, in both cases, to an abusive husband. And I thought that in itself kind of, it was a maybe too obvious political contemporary reading, but it kind of validated both stories in a strange way. It made both stories more interesting.
Well, that's an absolutely flat analogy. Saad's wife left him. As soon as he got out of prison, she left
him. Hillary Clinton's running for Senate in New York.
Well, okay. And the kind of not merely sexual activity, but violent cruelty and what we now have a name for, namely sadism, that was practiced systematically.
I'm not defending either sadism or Clintonism.
Well, but to put them together is to try to put together the opposite ends of the rainbow. This is a spectrum of behavior, and I don't think there's any connection. If she made that, I would love to. Francine Duplessis-Gray made that case, I think it holds no water. I think this is just trying to... There is something very contemporary about Saad, but it's not the Clintons in public office. It's the celebration in our advertising, in a great number of publications now, what goes on the Internet, of cruel sex. Sex which is not associated with loyalty, with love, with feeling, but with the desire to hurt someone. That, I think, does great danger to our species.
Fair enough. Second on your bad guy list.
Yeah, I put Consilience on here, the E.O. Wilson book about the unity of knowledge.
I disagree with you there, too,
yeah,
but go ahead.
Yeah, well, because I had just reviewed it, and although there's a great deal that is worthwhile in the book, and the man is a masterful expert on ants and other aspects of biology, he preaches something that he himself calls, I'm not calling, reductionism. The world's greatest authority on ants has written a book that seeks to make ants out of all of us. That's a kind of sentence which is playing a little bit for a reaction, but I think it's actually true about the book. Consilience preaches the doctrine that one explanation fits every phenomenon, namely reductionism, a position that Wilson explicitly affirms. Everything, including human behavior, can be reduced to the laws of physics and chemistry, and many scientists also would say this today. Molecular biology has paved over the last areas of doubt about consciousness and free will. That is, he reduces consciousness and free will also to chemistry and physics. Everything is determined, yet, this is the strange thing about the book, yet the book contains its own refutation in the last chapter by making us humans responsible for the ruining of the environment. That is, you can't hold us responsible if there is perfect determinism, which is his first argument. The last chapter, which is about the environment and what's happening to it, is very strong, and I would favor in every way, because it is written by the authority of a scientist. But it contradicts the earlier part of his book.
I got to say, I read him differently. I think in the continuum of scientists who write about consciousness, he's much more open to non-determinism, to mystery, to doubt, and religious language than a lot of the others, but that's just my reading of it. You take
well,
it
he uses those words, but he uses those words in order to submit them to reductionism. That is, he's trying eventually to wipe them out. And at the end of his earlier books, he almost always confounds himself in the last chapter. This is not the first time he's done it. He works through a kind of utopian picture of what we can do and then withdraws it in the last chapter because he realizes he's gone too far.
Well, that may be the telltale expression of doubt and a kind of fair warning to the reader. I think there are other writers like that who sort of sound a little alarm bell about their own text. Yeah. Forgive me for using that word, but go ahead.
Well, do you want me to go down the list?
Yeah, please.
Here you go. Okay. The third Anyone who's read Candor and Perversion would expect this, because I lambaste this gentleman in a couple of the chapters. Michel Foucault, Life and Writings. I didn't pull out one particular work. It's the whole example of his carryings on. Foucault stands directly and explicitly in the heritage of Sade. And this he says many times in his writings. He believes that a new era is going to be a new era of independence and total freedom was issued in by the Marquis de Sade, and Foucault celebrates this. Both men wished to detach sex from love, loyalty, and tenderness, and to associate it with cruelty and promiscuity. Foucault hoped to become a shaman, and wrote in a mumbo-jumbo prose that still impresses many natives. I also...
He's been pretty well kicked around. Never a certified friend of the connection, Michel Foucault.
Yeah, but he's there. Don't believe that he is going to go away because the connection has condemned him, or I have condemned him.
He's, we don't get down.
Well, I do. If I were the judge here, I would condemn him. Then I read the other titles, and you may want to pick them up. A totally unscientific book, which passed as a scientific book for a long time, was Kinsey's Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. He has been exploded as a charlatan several times over. Sartre's Life and Writings. This was hard to put in here. As a professor of French for many years, I taught Sartre when existentialism was the hottest thing going, and had many enthusiastic students who wished to continue this, and I find some of his works, namely Nausea, a great book. But his political trimming, his incapacity to come out when it was perfectly clear against the Soviet Union and against Stalin, puts him on my perversion list, and his influence was very great in favor of the Soviet Union. This is the treason of the intellectuals.
Our guest, Roger Shattuck, is a straight-talking reader of the great books. He's the reader we all want to be, who talks back, who keeps score, who believes literature is important, who doesn't get waylaid by the politics of identity or any of the sort of easy theoretical fashions of the moment, and we're... It's not even worthy of him, but we're making him the captain of the book club this hour on The Connection. And we're talking about his favorites, his all-time favorites, and his all-time least favorites. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 with Roger Shattuck, who has called the bluff of all kinds of modern literary fashion. Before we go to the phones, I'd just like you to give us sort of the short form of on the who you question. How did you get to be Roger Shattuck? How did this all happen that you became this kind of idealized, and in my view, independent reader?
The short answer to that is I like to be known as a journalist and a philologist. A journalist because that's where I started. As things happened when
covering
I...
Covering what for whom?
Well, I worked for the Chicago Daily News in Paris, taking the place of I was very young then. I was 25, I think, and replaced Fred Sparks, who went off for a long vacation for a month, and I wrote his column and did his work for a month with almost no experience, and I had to write in his style.
That'll teach you a lot.
It taught me a lot. And then continued really freelancing in Paris. And then I used to work for the Texas Observer when we were in Texas. But the idea of a deadline and a word limit are absolute essentials to learning how to write. And after I became a teacher, I always insisted that the journalism experience was the most valuable of all. Not journalism school, but writing for an editor who is going to hold you to the lines.
You've taught at Virginia as well as Texas, and for many years at Boston University. What did your opinions cost you over the years, or did they?
Well, yes, I've been spurned and spat at, literally. I used to do a good deal when the theaters and the drinking fountains were still segregated in Texas in 1956, when we went down there. We carried signs, and then later on I marched against the deployment of nuclear weapons and marched out to Bergstrom Field in Austin, Texas, and people threw beer cans at us and literally spat at us. That's not... millions of people have had that experience, but it's one that is a little less known now in this country.
I want to come back to this question of your identity as a kind of political lefty and a cultural righty, and how you were... That's much too simple a way to put it, but I want to come back to that. But I'd like to get the callers in on the club, too. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK with Professor Roger Shattuck. Andy is calling from a car.
Gentlemen.
Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. Gentlemen, fantastic discussion. Thank you very much. I'm getting an education just sitting here in the car. I have to disagree with your assertion on Sartre. Just kind of blew existentialism out of the water. But I wanted to get your opinion on two that were missing from your list. Great Gatsby by Fitzgerald and anything from Hemingway.
Well, I thought you were going to agree with me entirely after that introduction, but I'm glad you disagree. Well, existentialism, I was not trying to run existentialism down, because existentialism as a doctrine had no feelings, had no convictions about Stalin and the Soviet Union. But Sartre did, and he worked it into the network of his existentialist thinking. But nevertheless, he, as a person who had become almost the conscience of the West, did us a terrible disservice at the moment when he could have been a great hero, a great leader in opening our eyes to the horrors of communism back in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Now, Gatsby and Hemingway, yes, there's a bit of a perverseness, if I admit it, to my own list here. Fairly obvious and widely read candidates I tend to leave out. And The Great Gatsby and Hemingway's stories particularly have a fairly large role in my past, and they are there, but they just didn't make the cut of the top 10.
Andy, thank you for mentioning them anyway. 1-800-423-8255. The Roger Shattuck connection. His book is called Candor and Perversion. The phone's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi there. I wanted to make a plug. I was glad to hear that so much the philosophy that it included on your list, but I wanted to make a plug for, I'm not sure exactly how to call it, but nonfiction stories about people's lives. I think it's really important in education that we not only see great literature and imaginary people doing great things, but hear the stories about real people doing great things, too. The best example I can think of this is I'm in the middle of a book right now, which I think is an absolute American masterpiece, called Common Ground by J. Anthony Lucas. And it's truly one of the most extraordinary things I've ever read. My second comment is, as a Southerner, I could not agree with you more about Faulkner. I think that's a brilliant observation. He is truly one of the great American writers.
And Absalom in particular, Susan?
I prefer Sound and Fury, although Absalom is also a masterpiece.
Well, no differences there. Thanks, Susan. Now, nonfiction stories, yes, yes, yes. I'm in the process of, well, I just finished a book about, a book called The Long Walk, which is about a Pole arrested in Moscow, sent to a prison camp in Siberia, who escaped in the middle of winter in the most desperate circumstances and walked more and with six companions all the way to India, which is more than 2,000 miles. And it is, as you say, non-fiction story, a most moving story. I'm going to forget the name of the author now because it's an unpronounceable Polish name. But I recommend it to everyone who's listening to this program, The Long Walk, not by a prominent publisher, but is now in print. And it is, but I also remember the fact, this just comes to my mind as I talk to this idea of nonfiction stories. For the last 10 years, when he had retired and was in an armchair most of the time, my father read nothing but biography. At the end of his life, he felt that people's lives, real people's lives, well-narrated people's lives, were what he wanted to deal with.
And I quote the famous Emerson dictum, there is no history, there's only biography.
That's right. Well, that's a fine line, which I... You may have gotten from me since I did.
Yes, indeed. I get it again from you. We get it all the time.
Yeah, well, there's only biography. In other words, you have to take all these biographies and put them together to form history. But if you really see through history, you will see back to the biographies.
When you speak of nonfiction stories, as Susan did, just again, what are some of your favorites?
Well, you have one of my main favorites, which is the Helen Keller, and that's why it's there. It's a real story. Another story is my one that I tried to write myself, called The Forbidden Experiment, which is about the wild boy of Aveyron who came out of the woods naked and unhousebroken with no language in 1800 and was taken for the noble savage. He was not the noble savage. He was a poor castaway who had probably was meant to die in the woods. But his real story is as moving and as revealing philosophically and psychologically as any novel I know.
Roger Shattuck is our guest. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. This is a professor who believes that the good old rule had something in it, that colleges shouldn't teach living authors, that there's no book worth reading that isn't 100 years old, in other words.
That's a provocation, all right.
I'm just provoking you because we're going to take a short break and come back to it. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the Graduate School of International Economics and Finance at Brandeis, offering an information session on all programs on February 3rd, 800-878-8866, and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. I'm Christopher Ledden. This is The Connection with the one and only Roger Shattuck, what did Solzhenitsyn say about an intellectual as a kind of fortress? Roger Shattuck has many opinions on everything, all of them hard and individually earned. You have a wonderful theory in here, and I think we can talk about it on Family Radio, about the sort of the gonad theory of education and culture. The simple point being that it's in the kind of sexual organs that we preserve what we were before we were who we were, and that we transmit our genetic code kind of regardless of our life, what we learn, what we do well, what we do badly. We transmit a kind of repository of our genetic information intact, and that is your image of what education really ought to do. I wish you'd sort of develop it as the kind of kernel, the seed, so to speak, of your educational theory.
All right, you've done most of it for me, but I can elaborate on that. It also ties in with my educational theory, because in order to understand about gonads, you have to know the difference between mitosis and meiosis. And,
Which I don't.
Well, you should, because, and this is something that has to be in the curriculum, that you understand these things. Practically at birth, there is a separate group of cells set aside, which become our gonads, and the process of mitosis, which is simply cell division, undergoes a variation, and these become haploid cells, and they're set aside to be prepared for reproduction later in life when we mature. But these cells, from our birth, are set aside and protected, both in men and women. The gonads produce the eggs in women and the sperm in men. And in both cases, what we are born with is protected so that it can be transmitted whole and pure to the next generation without all our drunkenness and immorality and craziness affecting those cells which are going to pass on the human species. It is a protection against all the terrible things that can happen to us. As culture developed, there is no biological operation. There's no biological method which will do this for human culture. It is my hypothesis. I have no theories, but I have a hypothesis. Or better yet, I have this analogy, which is for culture, what we have gradually as human beings worked out is a process of tutoring our children, of bringing them up to what we consider our culture, and then finally an institution called schooling. And schooling in that is transmitting the best of our heritage to the next generation is the cultural equivalent of the gonads. And the gonads is a word that usually leads to laughter, but in this case it's dead serious. I think this is a way of understanding that the principal function of education is not to try to blow up the culture, to try to question everything without any knowledge, but to first of all transmit knowledge from one, transmit our heritage from one generation to the next, and then, after it has been transmitted, to examine it, to criticize it, perhaps to modify it in some way. But the order is what counts, and it grows out of that gonad theory.
You remind me that you write in the book about, as I said, being a political liberal who discovered, after all, that he was a cultural conservationist. Is that dialogue in your head still going on?
Well, yes, this it was a discovery that came gradually. And it came to some degree at the time that we decided we had to found a new association of literary scholars and called it the Association of Literary Scholars and Critics, which is set up in order to defend literature, as an activity which does not owe its allegiance to sociology or to rights of minorities or to political theory, that it is its own discipline. And it seems strange that that should have to happen. And when that was going on and when I became its president for a year, I came to the understanding that even though I am a political liberal who knew right away what the ACLS is, the American Civil Liberties Union, that in founding the ALSC, the Association for Literary Scholars and Critics, I was also not giving up my political liberalism, but asserting, in the name of these gonads, a kind of cultural, and I didn't call it conservatism, I call it conservationism. And this, I think, makes sense, that as our gonads are different from the rest of our body, as we have a reproductive system which operates quite separately, our education system also has as its first responsibility not to teach people to overthrow and to undercut the present culture, even the status quo, but to tell us how we got here historically and what its bases are. Then we certainly have full license to criticize it and to go at it.
Who are you forming that association against, so to speak? The Modern Language Association? Or?
Well, inevitably, it was qualified as a move against the Modern Language Association. Many of us remain members of the Modern Language Association, associate with it, and hope that we can have some effect there, too. But its principal function is not against some other existing function, but to affirm ways of teaching and studying and dealing with literature, which will not always make it subject to some other discipline.
You say in the book that people are supposed to know who the evil strip miners and clear cutters in literary enterprise are, but I don't know. Who are you talking about?
Well, I was talking at that time to the group assembled in a room where I read these 19 theses. Who were more or less in agreement. But the very list that we were going over a little earlier, the list of candid books and perverse books, is an attempt to lay out the difference. But on one hand, the strip miners, and then those who are not strip miners. The candid ones are the ones that I believe represent culture, and the perverse books are the books of.
But you were talking about people who are advocating them too. Who advocates the bad books, in your view?
All the post structuralists, the deconstructionists. That's the simpler part. I think that there are people who are trying very hard to affirm an anti-literary position. there, unfortunately, I think deeper down in the faculties of some universities and in among the teachers of some schools and high schools, there are those who have caught the bug and who are now feeling that that it is far more important to, in a literary course, in an English course, to talk about the abuse of minorities and the, let's say, the traditions of feminism, than it is to deal with direct literary values. I'm not saying that the first should be excluded, but they shouldn't have priority over the sense of what has survived 100 years, what, through its ideas, through its style, has convinced us that it is worthy of the name of literature.
Roger Shattuck is our guest. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. His book is called Candor and Perversion, and he names the candid heroes and the perverse monsters. 1-800-423-8255. Al is calling from Salem, New Hampshire.
Yeah, hi. I was prompted by the remark about you're currently reading The Long Walk, because I remember reading that book more than 40 years ago when I was a...
That's right. It came out a long time ago.
Yeah. I was 13, and that was one of the... I hadn't heard about anybody mentioning that book since that.
Now, what's the name of the author?
Slavomir Rawitz.
Rawitz, that's it.
R-A-W-I-C-Z. Okay?
Okay.
This brought to mind, I got the book because my parents had bought it, and I started reading it. I'm just wondering how you choose the books you're going to read. You're not rereading thoroughly books that you've read before. You're reading new books, obviously. And what goes into your process of selecting the book that
you're
going to read?
Well, in this case, I can tell you exactly how I heard about The Long Walk. It was from my son, who is a welder in Vermont, who had heard about it inevitably on the radio, and he'd heard it by a commentator on public radio in Vermont called Ron Powers, who had read the book and literally is plugging the book as much as he can. And it was soon after that I read it. It has come back in print from a small press in New York, and it is stunning. When you read the present edition, you realize that it came out yes about 40 years ago, and the events that it relates go back to the 1940s. Yes, I think it's 1941 and 1942. It's a stunning book.
Al, where do you get your book ideas?
I sort of emulate Tristram Shandy. I sort of move from one thought to the next, and they're more like a Lockean association of ideas, whatever sort of interests me at the time. And this is what seems to be the main enthusiasm I get from Mr. Shattuck.
Yeah, well, you also listen to the connection, you see.
Yes, well, that's also...
That's what connection means, isn't it?
Right. Well, I'm going to go get your book and read it, I think.
Oh, thanks.
Al, thank you for calling. It's called Candor and Perversion by Roger Shattuck. It's about literature, education, and the arts. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Roger Shattuck. Emily is on the line.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, Emily.
I was just calling because I was thinking of a great book that I'd read recently. Unfortunately, I've forgotten the name of the author, but I think it's a great compliment for both candor and perversion. It's called The New Passion of Eve. Are you familiar with it at all?
I'm not. Tell me about it.
It takes place, it was written by a British woman author around 1977. I think it's fallen out of print, and I wish I could remember her name right now. It takes place in America in the 90s, so she's writing about 15 years ahead of time. And what's happened is that American society has fulfilled some of the promises that you hate to hear so much from the deconstructionists. It has fallen to ruin, into disrepute, and taken over largely by gangs. And this this British fellow named Evelyn has come over to America and falls into all of this clamor and ends up getting accosted by super feminists and turned into a woman named Eve. And then it kind of goes from there. It's just a wonderful book talking about, talking about your theory with the gonads, talking about sexuality and education. And it's written in such rich words. It's a wonderful book. I just wanted to recommend that to people out there.
We owe people the name of an author here, but I guess we haven't got it.
The New Passion of Eve, no?
I don't have the author.
Okay.
But is that a book of at all like science fiction?
No.
No, it is made out as a kind of documentary.
Literary
imaginary
futurism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Literary futurism. Okay.
Right.
Well, I'll look it up. It sounds also very pertinent to an earlier book I wrote called Forbidden Knowledge, mm-hmm. which I discuss many of these things.
Okay, well, if you're looking for a quick read, it's not very long. It's
okay.
Absolutely wonderful.
Good.
Emily, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Roger Shattuck, presiding over the book club this hour. Arnold is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello, Arnold.
Yes, thank
Welcome.
You for calling my call. Take my call. Professor Shattuck, I just started reading Forbidden Knowledge. First of all, let me say I agree with your father about biography. As I've gotten older, I found it's the most
Good.
Worthwhile reading. You talk about your World War II experience.
Well, I do. Do you want me to say anything about that?
Well, I'm wondering how much influence this had on you in the rest of your life, because it was certainly quite an experience, and I think people should hear about it.
Let's hear it.
Before I get into that, though, I'm wondering how you can disregard Sartre and yet keep Kierkegaard on your list.
Well, that's because existentialism didn't take any political positions. And Kierkegaard is a greater writer than Sartre, I think. Sartre did a couple of books and was capable of doing something that he never really worked out. He was a very humorous man. But let's get back, if you want, to those 3 years I spent in the service, in the Army Air Corps, and half of that time in the Pacific. It started when I was 19 years old, and 3 years at that age will always leave a mark. Even if you're put in prison for the entire time, it will mark you for the rest of your life. But as it happened, I became a pilot and was first made an instructor, and found that both devilishly boring and dangerous. Dangerous because I didn't fly well enough really to instruct other people. So I volunteered to be sent to combat, and was sent not to Europe as I hoped, but to the Pacific. Not the South Pacific, that's the name of a musical comedy, but the Southwest Pacific. People have got to make that distinction. And started in New Guinea and worked up all the way to the Philippines and then to Okinawa. And the culmination of this, I suppose, although many, many other things happened during that time, mostly flying over water and having to do our own navigation. But on Okinawa, we were staging to invade Japan. And the bomb wing that I was put into at that time, during our training, we were told straight out to expect much greater than 50% casualties, which at our age and under the training that we had worked was not terrible. We were really too ready to accept those odds. But we weren't happy about it. And to run this all together, then one day all our bomb missions were suspended, and 2 days later we heard that something had happened. A bomb had been dropped on Japan, which had done untold damage, but at that point no one knew quite why. And then another one was dropped, and then we waited, and during that waiting time we didn't know what was going to happen until finally one day, over the PA system that was hung out on wires over the pup tents, over the pyramidal tents, a message went out that the war was over. And the war was over for reasons that we still couldn't understand. We didn't know the horrors behind it. All we knew was that we probably would have been wounded or died in the campaign that was coming. And that I still think is the case. I had a reaction against that. I flew up and saw Hiroshima from the air later, and I read the book about it by Hershey, and then turned very strongly against the atomic bomb and nuclear weapons as something which would be perhaps the end of the world. And then I did another flip-flop when I learned, after demonstrating against atomic weapons, that in all probability the very horror of this standoff, of this balance of terror between us and the Soviet Union, had saved us an unconscionably long time from war. So that it is, I still am fighting a battle about atomic weapons and nuclear weapons. They are obviously horrible, but at that juncture in history, it may have been the only thing that could prevent us from going to war with the Soviet Union. And that probably would have been worse, despite all the horrors that we've talked about in the Soviet Union. So that's the background, and that in part led me to the notion of forbidden knowledge. But that's not our topic today.
Arnold, I'm so glad you provoked that piece of the biography that I didn't know. 1-800-423-8255, the Roger Shattuck connection. Emma is on the line.
Hi, my question is not as serious as the last caller's, but I was wondering what Professor Shattuck would say about the relationship between deconstructionism and his theories of learning, or such theories as reader response. Do you consider them mutually exclusive?
Well, not entirely. Deconstructionism is an attempt to find the Achilles heel, find the weak point of practically any major piece of writing.
April 1st at 9.
And this is no joke, and thanks a lot.
Agonistic frame of mind, and this is the way students would be taught to read anything: Shakespeare, Milton, the Bible. Look for the contradictions. Look for everything that is going to prove that this is not a classic.
I'm a student at Barnard College, and certainly we have been taught to examine texts from these different theories of criticism, and I haven't found that they lead to a disrespect for. In fact, we just read Paradise Lost from a reader response point of view, without losing a profound respect for the text.
Oh yes, well that might very well be, but the reader response approach is not deconstruction really. But what I object to is what I call the age of appliances. One always has a theory or an approach which is then applied to what you read, in this case, Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost doesn't need a theory or an approach. In the essay at the end of the book called, in another book I wrote called The Innocent Eye, you don't need to come equipped with all kinds of weapons and protections that you're going to approach the book with. You approach with the simplest, most unprotected way in order to expose yourself to the book, and then gradually it will come to you how that book asks to be read. You do not have to oppose your own theory to it. That's the reader response. I don't object to too much, although I think that even is unnecessary baggage.
Thank you. That'll do it. Before I forget, Angela Carter, and I should have remembered this, is the author of The Passion of Eve, the 70s novel that a caller spoke about. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Beatrice is on the line.
Hi, I wanted to, I guess I'm one of the post-structuralists or whatever it is that you're calling us in your show, but I wanted to bring in the question of Foucault. I started listening to the...
Michel Foucault.
Uh-huh.
We got to do it fast, Beatrice.
One of the things that I wanted to say is that Michel Foucault has given us a new understanding of the relationship of power, how power is constituted. It's given us a new understanding of the issue of knowledge and how it comes to be constructed, and I guess that this is really important point now that Emma just called, because the response was, you know, we're imposing a theory and unnecessary baggage onto what we read. But the truth of the matter is that whenever we approach the text, we're already a constituted subject. Therefore, we already have knowledges, ideologies, and all of these things that we come to the text with, and we cannot say that we have an innocent eye to read them.
Because we're deep in the theory already.
Beatrice, I've already lost you. You have said things that I cannot follow.
Oh, sure you can.
Anyone that says text, I reject it.
You just don't want to go there. We never quite finished these arguments about theory. We started a little late, Beatrice, but thank you. And Roger Shattuck, thank you for joining us. We should do this once a month.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll get to the post-structuralists. Roger Shattuck's new book is called Candor and Perversion. We had help today from John Hoder, Walter Dixon, Brian Myers, Ted Curry, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors at law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients, and by Sunday River Ski Resort, featuring 8 interconnected mountains, 126 trails to explore, and an extensive snowmaking system, SundayRiver.com. PRI, Public Radio International.